ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and I recently sat down with Dr. Jay Richards, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-author of the well-known book, The Privileged Planet, to discuss the intersection of science and faith, as well as the popular astronomer and agnostic Carl Sagan. Richards and I talked about The Privileged Planet and the growing evidence over the last two decades that has even enhanced the arguments he and Gonzalez made at the time. We also discussed Sagan's misunderstanding of the pre-Copernican view of cosmology, as well as a response Sagan gave to the question about God's existence in a Q&A following a lecture he delivered. In this last part of our conversation, we analyzed Sagan's argument that by setting aside our belief in God, we can finally get around to the hard work of saving ourselves. It's a provocative claim, to be sure, but does it hold up to scrutiny? We join the conversation now by hearing a brief clip from Sagan himself. I'm going to play this clip now from the video, Jay, and the question from the audience member that we'll hear at the beginning is essentially, if you're right, Sagan, and God doesn't exist, then what? Where does that leave us? And then we'll hear Sagan's response.
It seems that through the ages, humans have created a mythological framework that has always involved some kind of, often involves some kind of higher spiritual powers. And as
every human culture has done that,
as that goes away, as we know more and more that, and it seems harder and harder to prove that anything might exist like that, where does that leave us?
On our own. Which to my mind is much more responsible than hoping that someone will save us from ourselves so we don't have to make our best efforts to do it ourselves. And if we're wrong, and there is someone who steps in and saves us, okay, that's all right. I'm for that, but we, you know, hedged our bets. Mm-hmm. It's Pascal's bargain run backwards.
All right, so you can hear Sagan say, being on our own is much more responsible than hoping that someone will save us from ourselves so that we don't have to make our best efforts to do it ourselves. And he talks about Pascal's bargain in reverse, I think more commonly known as Pascal's wager, which is something of a interesting, if controversial, thought experiment or proposal about how we should live our lives. Tell us what's normally meant by Pascal's wager.
Yeah, the idea is that, let's say you don't know for sure if there's a God, but there's infinite benefit. If there is a God, and by believing in him, there's the benefit would be eternal life with God, then that's on the one side. But let's say there's not a God, and so you don't believe. Well, there's really not a lot of benefit to not believing in God, because if you're wrong, then you're just going to die, and God doesn't exist, so you cease to exist. But if he does, then, you know, there's sort of infinite bliss. And so the idea, and you can make it much more sophisticated than that, is that, therefore, really, you know, it seems rational to believe in God because you've got infinite value on one side and you're not losing a lot on the other side. Sagan, of course, turns that around, but he turns it around by, first of all, completely misconstruing Judeo-Christian religious belief. And this is how he speaks in his book, Pale Blue Dot, is that this hope that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. If this was true, let's just take Christianity. If the fundamental belief in Christianity was that, well, it doesn't matter what we do because God's going to come and save us from ourselves, then why did Christians create universities? Why did Christians start virtually all the hospitals that have ever been started, right? Why did they start schools, right? Why do they start orphanages? Why do they start organizations to help the poor? I mean, this is all just nonsense because, of course, the Christian idea is not that it doesn't matter what we do now because God will come to help elsewhere. In fact, Jesus says, well, the greatest commandment is love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And second is to love your neighbor as yourself. And so the test of whether you love God is whether you love your neighbor. And so Sagan, of course, what he does is he presents this really kind of absurd religious idea that almost no one actually holds and then says, well, that's worse than us just kind of trying to do this on our own. But of course, those aren't the options. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, on the other hand, what is that atheistic idea? Because he's saying that there's a kind of moral preference for being atheistic, because presumably it's going to inspire us to do greater works for humanity or something. Is there any evidence of that at all in societies that are overwhelmingly atheistic? Are they more humane? Do they build more hospitals? I mean, there's no evidence for that at all. And so Sagan, you know, he was a great science communicator, but he often was really kind of simplistic when it came to basic logic. And so he creates this massive straw man that doesn't actually represent Judeo-Christian religion at all, in order to then posit, well, yeah, what's better, to falsely believe that somebody's going to save you and so not do anything, or to not really know and so then therefore try to help yourself? Well, given that dilemma, the answer is obvious, but that's not the actual dilemma that we have before us.
Right, right. Yeah, and if, you know, from time to time, I'm sure you can find somebody who says something like, well, it doesn't really matter because in the end, you know, God's going to step in. But I think that you've articulated really well that that's not actually the position, certainly of Christianity, but even of most religious traditions, that, you know, the doctrine is not, well, sit on your hands and wait around until someone comes to save you.
And what's funny, and what's sort of behind this, and people, you have to be old enough to remember this, but there was a claim in the 90s. So this interview is from the 90s, but I remember Sagan was around in the 80s when I think the Secretary of the Interior under President Reagan was a guy named James Watt, and he was an evangelical Christian. And people got this idea. He was asked about why we should be good stewards, you know, and save forests and stuff. And he said, well, you know, it's something, as soon as the last tree is felled, then Jesus will return. So in other words, it doesn't really matter. It's like a completely made up. It was made up, I think, by Bill Moyers on PBS. It's a complete lie. Watt's never said anything like that. But that they literally had to create a story like this, of that being the Christian idea, that, okay, we can destroy the earth because Jesus is going to come back. Because they didn't even actually have an example of a real person that said that. Now, yeah, I'm sure you always find somebody that says something kind of strange, but yeah. That's certainly not the general Christian view, that it doesn't matter what we do because God's going to save us. I mean, there's not a single representative Christian theologian that's ever made that argument.
So you're not just sitting around waiting to be saved, Jay. You're going to the Gilder Conference.
Exactly. You know, I mean, Jesus, look, you know, the second great commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah, and if you have the view that my fellow human beings have intrinsic value, that they have, you know, long-term value, that they're important, then I would be inclined to do that. Furthermore, if I believe that I've been commanded to reach out and assist and strengthen and uplift others, then I'm going to be inclined to do that,
apparently. No, that's right. Yeah. And people used to really understand this. I mean, the claim isn't that, well, unless an atheist believes in God, he can't be just to his fellow human beings. That is not the argument. Sure. Because, of course, you know, and I debated Christopher Hitchens many years ago, and I made this point with him, is that I said, look, Christopher knows murder is wrong just as well as I do. We both know it's wrong. The question is, what is the status of moral truths in an atheistic universe? If materialism is true, really consistent atheists are usually quite clear about this, that there's no free will. Everything's determined by the laws of physics. So the moral truths are these kind of weird illusions at best. But to me, the fact that even atheists know moral truths, what should happen is you say, okay, in what view of reality do moral truths make the most sense? Mm-hmm. Because look, if there's a natural law that's built into things, that's ultimately sort of, you know, there's a transcendent personal creator who is intrinsically good, then you got a really good framework for moral truths. If you're an atheist and a materialist, you know moral truths like the rest of us, but you really don't have a coherent way of accounting for them. And in fact, materialism and atheism, what they do is they tend to encourage this kind of reduction of moral truths to some other kind of thing.
Yeah, this reminds me, I want to, if it's all right, share an anecdote. I was talking with a friend he was complaining about a religious organization that was using resources to build a temple rather than help people, mm-hmm. he said, and he sort of implied that if we abandoned the religious side of it, then embraced a form of atheism, we'd be better off and could do more good in the world. And certainly there are many, many wonderful atheists who are contributing to their community in positive ways. I count some mm-hmm. of them as friends. Right. But I expressed my serious doubts that there was anything even remotely approaching the community outreach and service that's provided by faith-based organizations. I served for a time on our local city Housing and Human Services Commission, and there were many faith-based organizations, primarily Christian, but others as well, mm-hmm. that were running, you know, soup kitchens, providing elder care, services for the homeless, after school programs for youth, and on and on. And there are lots of secular non-religious organizations that are also doing great work in the community. But if we're making a comparison, as my friend kind of was, that, you know, organized religion versus some type of organized atheism, whatever that might be, just not even in the ballpark. And, you know, you could argue about why that might be. But I think, you know, I pointed that out to him, and to his credit, he said, yeah, okay, that's true. We need to do a lot better on the atheist side of, you know, organizing ourselves and doing some things in the community that are positive and uplifting. But it really gives the lie to kind of Sagan's view here that, gee, if we would abandon our belief in God, then we could do better work in the world.
Great things. Yeah. And the other thing is, I think you could make the case that atheism in the developed world is parasitic. And so it's just atheists off. You'll have a college, right, that's started by Puritans, or a hospital that's started by Baptists or Catholics, you know, that might sort of institutionally go to seed so that atheists or agnostics end up sort of in charge of it. But the question is, would that atheism, if expanded to a culture as a whole, would it have inspired initially the creation of those things? Mm-hmm. Probably not. It was only the 20th century that entire societies tried to organize themselves around atheism. It's not a pretty picture. It's just not a pretty picture. So the fact that individual atheists continue to believe that there's this intrinsic dignity to human beings just by virtue of being human, to me, that's a kind of residue of a particular view of reality that was a part of our historical patrimony that is sort of dying out. And if you just sort of start an atheist society somewhere, I don't think there's any good reason to think that that would be an especially common belief, or that it would at least be very robust.
Yeah. So the next item that Sagan talked about, you know, he mentions, okay, once we set aside this belief in a creator and a God, then we can go about the work of saving ourselves. And that raises for me the question, saving ourselves from what?
Yeah.
If there's no, look, under the atheist doctrine, at least a strong version, there's no more meaning in the interactions of the molecules and the matter and the electrical impulses that make up me than in the rocks crashing about in the asteroid belt. And even a softer version of atheism or agnosticism that would argue for some temporary current value or purpose in life, which arose inexplicably from purposeless or valueless natural processes. But okay, there's some kind of temporary current value or purpose in life. Even this ephemeral temporary purpose or meaning must eventually give way to meaninglessness. You know, our ultimate destiny is nothingness from dust back to dust. So it kind of raises the question, what are we saving ourselves from if there's, you know, if matter, if the cosmos is all there is?
No, that's right. And again, there's a kind of a parasitic idea here. And what I think Sagan is talking about, just based on his writings at the time and when he's used that, is he's usually talking about saving the earth effectively. Mm-hmm. And so he thinks we're going to destroy ourselves. And he was, of course, really worried that we were going to nuke ourselves to death. And then later he was worried about climate issues. And so the idea is that, well, if there's nowhere we can go, right, earth is the only place that we have, then maybe we'll treasure it more. I think that's sort of his idea. But of course, that presupposes various things, right? And I mean, that's the sort of irony, is that in some ways, the idea of environmental stewardship, right? The word itself, it's one of the only things that's found its way into the popular culture and is even in the scientific literature that's an explicitly theological idea. Because if you're a steward, you've been placed, you've been given responsibility over something. And so if we're stewards of the earth, you have to say, okay, now who gave us responsibility over the earth? And it's not even exactly clear what the motivation would be for saying, well, let's preserve the earth for future generations. I mean, why would we have moral obligation to future generations? Maybe there's only so much to go around. We'll just use it up now. It's not exactly clear to me how you resist that argument in kind of strictly materialistic terms, or that you justify, say, expending resources on people that are not very productive. Yeah. I can imagine a really hardcore utilitarian argument that goes in a really, really dark direction. And so the fact that people like Sagan may have these kind of humanistic instincts, I don't think is any assurance that that's how this would go if atheism suddenly were, you know, to just control the minds of everyone's thinking.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. And there's certainly some people who are heading, not Sagan, but people who are heading the direction of, hey, we ought not be preserving those who are less fit and those kind of things.
Oh, absolutely. And we shouldn't have children, you know, we shouldn't have children because that's going to use up resources. So the very way you view human beings, are we creators made in the image of God to to create and to innovate, or are we basically resource consumers? You know,
right.
You can't finally, your kind of moral vision and your anthropology is going to shape your whole understanding of this. And so that's why, again, Sagan, just as he wanted to redefine God to refer to the laws of physics here, when he's talking about saving ourselves, he means it in a very, he really means to sort of save the planet from our destruction.
Yeah, and there's a lot to commend in his practical approach and what he right. was trying to do that's good for humanity. But as you say, what's the basis, what's the underlying way that you can find purchase for that effort within an agnostic or atheistic viewpoint? So
yeah,
so,
exactly.
So just let me play devil's advocate for a minute. We've kind of skirted around it a little bit, but let me yeah. say it directly. There's lots of atheists and agnostics who are better people than I am, who are working hard for the betterment of humanity, and there are lots of really lousy Christians.
Yeah.
How do we square up with that?
I think the truth of the matter is everybody knows some bad religious person and yeah. some person that's sort of atheist or agnostic, and that's just sort of the reality of the world in which we live. And that's certainly not inconsistent with the Christian view of things. I mean, you know, Paul talks about the Gentiles who do what the law requires, even though they haven't been given. He's talking about the sort of Romans that don't have the Ten Commandments, but they still do what the law requires because the law has been written on their hearts. There's this idea mm-hmm. that there is a natural law that people have access to. And so people have genuine moral knowledge. And also people differ in terms of their disposition. I mean, anyone that has children knows this. People have different operating systems, different software that gets loaded on, right? So some people are just kind of in, they just start out, and nicer.
That's my problem.
Yeah, you know, Evelyn Waugh, the great British novelist, you know, who wrote Brideshead Revisited, there's a story, probably apocryphal, where somebody said, Mr. Waugh, you know, you're a Catholic, such a serious Catholic, but why are you such an awful person? He said, oh, you can't imagine how awful I would be if I weren't Catholic. You
know? Right, exactly.
And so that's just the kind of the human reality. And so I think what we want to think about is, okay, if you're going to sort of talk about preferences, would you prefer that there be a culture in which people generally believe that human beings have intrinsic value and dignity as creatures made in the image of God and should be treated both interpersonally and in terms of the institutions of society in a way that recognizes that intrinsic value and dignity, or a culture in which everybody's told that we're the result of this blind and pitiless process of natural selection and blind physical forces.
And it's the survival of the fittest, right?
Yeah, and it's survival of the fittest. Yeah, I mean, so the fact that individual atheists or Christians may not sort of match what you would expect, I think, is not the primary question. And then the key thing is that, look, if a Christian treats someone cruelly, he is being a hypocrite. He's contradicting his yeah. moral position. And so you can actually appeal to him, right? That's the kind of key thing is if you say somebody's being a hypocrite, in some ways that's the point, because you say, look, why are you treating people so terribly? You claim to love God and you're supposed to love your neighbor. And that has purchase in principle. And mm-hmm. so in some ways, kind of we recognize that, look, you really ought to act according to this moral code, but you don't. That is, in a sense, a signal of the kind of prior reality of the moral code.
Yeah. And it means that, you know, I as a Christian, when I misbehave, am falling short of my doctrine.
Yes, exactly.
And on the other side of the coin, if we have an atheist who's behaving well, that means they've risen above their doctrine.
Yeah, exactly. And they are following the law written on their hearts, but they're doing it. And that's why I say, because I really think what happens in reality is that we have, yes, there is a natural law written on our hearts, but it's also kind of vague and we have a hard time following it. And so we actually also need, I think, the kind of explicit teachings of religion and special revelation that reinforces that. And so it's not one or the other. You want both of those things, I think, working in tandem. And then when you have both of those, some of us at least are minimally virtuous, right? You know, we're just slightly more virtuous than we would be otherwise.
Yeah, only one good, right?
So yeah, exactly.
Well, that's really great. I like the way you articulated that. So final thoughts, Jay. Now, a couple decades on from Sagan's discussion, what's your view? Is the science slowly but surely pushing belief in God out the window and making it less tenable? Or does your research and the research of others like Steve Meyer in his new book point to something else?
I think it's absolutely something else. I mean, we have to distinguish institutional science and big science from the evidence of science itself. That's what's important about Steve's new book is that he says, look, let's look at the real evidence that's been discovered. And mm-hmm. so, and in many ways, you have people like Hubble and and Einstein with the development of this idea that the universe is dynamic and expanding and had a beginning in the past. These were not people that actually, even on their own views, wanted to countenance that. In fact, Hubble never liked it, never liked this idea. And I don't know that he ever even really quite believed it. But that's testimony to how strong the evidence is, that even, you know, for people that didn't really want to believe the implications and weren't looking for it, to discover that the universe had a beginning, that mm-hmm. the laws and constants of physics are fine-tuned for the existence of complex life, that at the origin of life itself is this incredible informational event, right? None of these things would be expected or welcomed in the materialistic framework, and yet they're part of the deposit of our knowledge from natural science. And so I think for people who believe in God, there's never been a better time to live, at least with respect to the evidence of nature.
Yeah, the book of nature is really starting to be opened up. Well, Jay, thanks so much for being with us today to discuss this critical intersection of science and religion. This is a really valuable topic that, if anything, is even more current today than it was when Sagan spoke a few decades ago. So really appreciate you being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Eric. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. Join us again at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. If you find these discussions to be a valuable contribution to the public conversation about these topics, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.